A California couple sees climate change as an extreme challenge. They're trying to beat it by making a blueprint for ecosystems, starting with the desert.
We have real scientific methods that we can use to actually address the problem.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, a look at the feasibility of cataloging and recreating changing landscapes. And how do you know if you have lead in your home plumbing?
If you scrape it just a little bit, you see how it's got that bright silver color to it.
We head into the basement to find out. Plus, a photographer is trying to make people care about endangered plants with a blender.
Kind of like making a really disgusting smoothie.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Air emissions from the natural gas industry were up in 2014. That's according to new data released by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Emissions come from places like the drilling rigs themselves and engines used to run gas facilities. DEP says the numbers are up because more gas was produced in 2014 compared to the previous year, and there were more facilities reporting emissions. To get a better idea of what these data mean, we turn to the Allegheny Front's energy reporter, Reid Frazier. So, Reid, what are the pollutants being emitted, and how can they impact people's health?
So these include pollutants that are in themselves just bad to breathe in, like volatile organic compounds or sulfur dioxide. And they can also lead to other air pollution problems that are really of concern, like ozone or fine particulate matter. So both ozone and particulates have been linked to heart and lung disease, like bronchitis, asthma, heart attack, things like that. And the pollution can also include climate-changing gases like methane, which is much more powerful than carbon dioxide when it gets into the atmosphere. One of the biggest increases that we saw was in sulfur dioxide, which went up by 40% in 2014 in the natural gas sector. But we saw a big decrease in sulfur dioxide on the side of coal-fired power plants. So as there are fewer coal-fired power plants or there are more pollution controls put on these plants, the sulfur dioxide emissions from them goes down. And we saw a much larger decrease in sulfur dioxide in coal plants than we saw an increase in the natural gas industry. So in that way, you might see it as a pretty decent trade-off for the air quality in Pennsylvania.
Still, a 40% increase in sulfur dioxide, and there was a 25% increase in VOCs. Are the numbers up like that across the board for all of the pollutants in the data that DEP released?
No, there are some areas where we're seeing a much smaller rate of increase, including methane. And one thing you see is that from 2012 to 2014, there's actually a decrease in methane emissions in Pennsylvania. So why is that happening? The DEP says one reason is that companies have gotten better at finding and fixing leaks. But there's another potential reason for this, and that's regulation. In 2012, the EPA created new rules that were aimed at cutting down methane emissions at a certain stage of the drilling process. And lo and behold, in 2014, you see steep declines in methane emissions at this stage of the drilling process. Over 2 years, it's more than a 90% drop in methane emissions at that stage of the process.
What does the increase in air emissions from the gas industry overall mean for people who live in Pennsylvania? Does it affect people who live near gas development more?
So one of the biggest arguments in favor of drilling and fracking for natural gas is that it's much cleaner to burn than coal, which a lot of people have heard. So we're seeing statewide these large decreases in pollution from power plants, mainly from a decline in coal pollution. But what we're also seeing are local increases in pollution near gas infrastructure. So things like hazardous air pollutants, which can be carcinogenic or cause neurological problems, have increased in counties where there's a lot of drilling. Washington County, for instance, the benzene levels there have increased in 2014 again. So that could be a negative local impact from the natural gas production there.
Now, one of the things I noticed is that this emissions data that DEP released is self-reported by the gas industry. So is it reliable?
Good question. Anything that's self-reported is obviously there's some type of risk for underreporting, but we haven't really seen any evidence of that happening in Pennsylvania. One issue that these reports have is that they're based on estimates that actually the EPA conducted several years ago as to how much pollution a given piece of equipment might produce. Basically, they're educated guesses, and they don't account for things like leaks or fugitive emissions or or when a piece of equipment's not operating correctly. In fact, former DEP Secretary John Quigley even said earlier this year that actual emissions are higher than what the DEP is receiving in these reports, and that the agency doesn't really know what the actual emissions are.
Also, the numbers that we're talking about are for 2014, but the industry has been in a lull recently. So should we expect to see another report that says these same pollutants are down?
Yeah, that's entirely possible. So the number of drilling rigs in the state actually dropped significantly in 2015. So you would imagine that pollution from the drilling process itself may very well be going down. But also to keep in mind is even though the number of drilling rigs went down, the actual production of gas in the state basically stayed level at a very high level in 2015. So there are some aspects of natural gas pollution that maybe stay the same.
Reed Frazier reports on energy for the Allegheny Front. Thanks, Reed.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Reed's written more about air pollution from the gas industry. That's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. You can find DEP's latest air emissions data there, too. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. When it comes to doing something about climate change, whether it's government officials trying to agree on emissions reductions or scientists trying to pull greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, the odds seem long. But there are people willing to play those odds, no matter how impossible their chances. Reporter Sandin Totten recently spent some time with two people like that, a couple from Los Angeles.
Before we get to the project at the heart of this story, let me tell you about the people. Jess and Carlos Pelaez have always been big thinkers. Take the very first time they met. This was 7 years ago at a bar in Los Angeles. Jess and Carlos were both designated drivers that night. Carlos spotted Jess in the crowd, and pretty soon he was chatting her up. He remembers telling her about this crazy plan he had to mine an energy source called helium-3 from the moon.
And that if you can get a space shuttle's worth of helium-3, that you could power an entire city like LA for a year.
Helium-3 is this super rare kind of helium that could possibly power nuclear plants. It's maybe even more rare as an effective pickup line.
And then she told me that her thesis advisor was a premier helium-3 scientist, and there's more helium-3 in the bottom of the ocean, and it's a lot easier to get it there than the moon. And I thought, hey, this sounds great. Let's go to the bottom of the ocean and let's mine for helium-3 instead of going to the moon.
Jess and Carlos are like this all the time. They're married now, and they still constantly bounce ideas like this off each other, which brings us to what they're doing these days. A few years back, Jess says she started feeling like she was watching some slow-moving disaster. It was stuff she read, saw on TV. Coral reefs, forests, deserts she visited and loved were dying from pollution and climate change.
And thinking about how when they're gone, they're just completely gone forever. And saying, but wait, it's almost, you know, like we have the technology. We can rebuild him. You know, it was that sort of, well, why can't we fix these things now?
Jess and Carlos came up with a plan. A big one. It's a plan that, when you hear it, it sounds one part completely reasonable and one part utter science fiction. Here's the idea. They'd go to threatened ecosystems and catalog everything. The plants, the animals, the rocks, the weather. Then create detailed records for all of it. Here's the sci-fi part. They want to take those blueprints and use them to rebuild these places in giant warehouses for safekeeping. Like backup copies of ecosystems. They call the plan Blueprint Earth.
So we'll have a desert, we'll have a tundra, we'll have grasslands, we'll have, you know, rainforest, we'll have wetlands and swamps, and eventually oceans.
Jess and Carlos know how this sounds. Just to be clear, they're practical people. Jess went to school for science. She's a geologist. Carlos works in tech. He consults for Fortune 500 companies. And they've gone about starting this super big idea in a very practical way. They started small, with a nonprofit, setting aside a few thousand dollars and signing up volunteers. Then they picked a place close by, the Mojave Desert, and decided to make this the test case. Soon, Jess and Carlos were going on regular trips out into the desert to actually do the thing they dreamed up. When I went out with them, some part of me expected Jess and Carlos to be working with a small army of scientists in white coats with fancy bioscanning lasers. In reality, it was a half dozen mostly 20-somethings with cameras and these metal box traps.
What we're doing is we're laying out these traps and we're trying to get the little rodents to go inside them.
We have one?
One of the volunteers, Teresa Cabrera, pulls a small brown canyon mouse from the metal box.
I love him.
He is smiling.
He's so cute.
Oh, he's so cute. Look at him.
Ow! Oh, he bit me.
Don't worry, she's fine. She examines the mouse, takes detailed notes, then lets it go. The whole thing feels like a field trip. All day long, volunteers are flipping over rocks, looking for bugs, taking notes on the weather, scooping up samples of pond water. What they're doing is basic science, documenting the things around them, nothing flashy. The leap comes when you try to connect the dots all the way to the big dream that Carlos and Jess have. How do you go from notes they're scribbling to a warehouse with the Mojave Desert inside it? There's so many details. Like, what do you do about the weather? Or large animals like bighorn sheep? It would be cruel to lock them in a warehouse, but they're clearly part of this ecosystem.
So what we would do, though, is we need to find a way to source bighorn sheep poop and urine so that we can actually replicate the effects of that weathering into the environment.
I'd love to see that Craigslist wanted ad.
Please give me bighorn sheep poo. Yeah, no, we hope to work with people who have a lot of them, like managed herds, sanctuaries. You know, that's where we'll get a lot of that stuff.
Jess and Carlos are not the first people to think something like this should be done, or that it's possible, or to actually try it. Maybe you remember Biosphere 2. It was a massive structure built in Arizona in the 90s. It was supposed to house different sealed and self-sustaining ecosystems. The thing cost $200 million and was a huge flop. Oxygen levels crashed, plants and animals died, huge flop. I talked to the Biosphere folks. They said they salute Jess and Carlos's plan and all their effort, but basically, good luck with that. Jess and Carlos are working on the same dream as the Biosphere team, just a smaller version. But the warehouse they scoped out would cost $8 million. Jess is working with no salary. Blueprint Earth has just $3,000 in the bank. That's just, let's see, $7,997,000 to go. Yeah.
Good day.
Great day.
The sun is setting. Big rocks around us cast long, dark shadows. It's getting cold, and everyone's stuffing notebooks and bug nets and water bottles back in their bags. So, at the end of the day here in the Mojave, seven volunteers working from morning to night, I wondered, how'd we do? According to Jess and Carlos, how much progress did we make toward a blueprint of the Mojave?
About 3%.
We spent all day today just covering about 3% of what you're trying to do?
And we haven't covered 100% of what we need to cover within this 3%. What percentage complete are we on this 3%?
80. 80, 85.
And this is just the test case. Remember, they want to catalog the whole planet. That night, back at the camp, Jess and I sit around the fire, drinking, talking. So much of this is riding on her. She's Blueprint Earth's founder, fundraiser, leader, and cheerleader all rolled into one. Listening to her talk, it's amazing how much she believes in what they're doing, even while talking about how much money they need, how much time.
But I wonder, like you were saying today, you know, we looked at 85% of 3%. Like, we looked at the small fraction of what you really needed to do, and like, when you told me that number, it kind of blew my mind. I was like, man, there's so much to do. And then I thought, you've basically just like built one brick for the Taj Mahal, but you still have the rest of the Taj Mahal to build.
Yep. Yeah, it's huge. It's impossible. We're never going to get it perfect, and we're never going to do all of it. It's almost like tilting at windmills, except we have real scientific methods that we can use to actually address the problem. If we can show people that, yes, it is possible to create an environmental blueprint, then from there, ideally, we'll get more support, right? People will know what we're doing.
Why does it mean so much to you?
I think because it's bigger than pretty much anything else I could do. A lot of people have kids. Their hopes and dreams are passed on for the next generation through having kids. Our legacy will not be that. I love other people's kids, but I'm not the, I've never had a maternal instinct, not once in my entire life. Our legacy needs to be something different, and I would rather try it and have partial success. I don't want to see this place turn into a museum exhibit, and that's it. But if it is, and that's the only memory we have of it, fine, I'll take that. I'll take that over nothing.
She'll take that over nothing. Hearing that from Jess, you realize that's the thing. No matter how likely or unlikely Jess and Carlos feel it is that they really will someday, however far away, create a backup version of the Mojave Desert and jungles and oceans and swamps, the comparison they're making is to do nothing. And whether it's having some partial record of this one place they care about, or some scientists learning something from what they're trying to do, falling short for them is still better than doing nothing. Jess and Carlos feel very sure of that. Reporting from Los Angeles, I'm Sandin Totten.
That story comes to us from WBEZ's Heat of the Moment. For more stories about everyday life on a changing planet, head to our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Getting kids outside and away from their screens isn't always easy. One program introduces kids to the river.
At first, I thought the boat was going to flip over. It was going to be terrible. But it turned out to be surprisingly fun.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we're going dragon boating with kids who are getting a greater appreciation of nature and each other.
Paddles up, go!
Paddles up, and stay tuned.
Paddle together, guys.
Sometimes plants just don't get as much love as animals, like the bighorn sheep or the mouse we heard about earlier. It can be hard to get people fired up about an endangered plant. But one photographer is trying to do just that. Rebecca Williams has more.
Jane Kramer is a fine art photographer. She takes photos of the shadows of rare or threatened plants and then prints them on paper that she makes out of invasive plants, like garlic mustard and purple loosestrife, species found throughout the region. I met up with Kramer at a lake in a large metro park in Michigan.
So we're gonna put in our kayaks just off this little park, go around the bend, and there are a few patches of American lotus, which is what we're gonna photograph the shadow of.
We paddle up to a patch of American lotus, its huge yellow petals sticking up out of the water. My job is to hold a white foam board behind the flower, very, very still.
And we're gonna try to get close to it so we can, so I can shoot from one side and then capture the shadow on the whiteboard while you hold it behind it. Okay, so if you hold it right there.
Kramer's drawn to things that are fragile or easily overlooked and have an element of secrecy.
The location of some of these plants is kept secret because of poachers, because they're afraid of people coming and either taking the plants or taking the seeds.
After she takes photos of the shadows of rare plants, she tackles the flip side of the project, the invasives that threaten them. When I show up at her house, she's cooking chopped garlic mustard on a stove in her garage.
All right, so I'm just gonna dump this into the pot.
Then we go to Kramer's laundry room, where she rinses the cooked plants and puts them in the blender.
Kind of like making a really disgusting smoothie.
Then she uses a wood frame to make the pulp into paper. Most of it turns out light brown. Sometimes it's green. Japanese knotweed is a very dark red.
Now we come to the most stressful part of the whole project.
Kramer prints the shadow images on special transfer films. She has a magic ingredient to get the shadow photos onto the invasive plant paper, hand sanitizer. The alcohol releases the ink from the transfer paper.
We squirt the gel on. And then use the brayer. And then you carefully lift up. And you'll see that not all the ink came off, but I really like how that looks.
It's a delicate looking shadow of a flower, the prairie coreopsis.
You know, the paper is invasive plant, made from an invasive plant. The shadow is an endangered plant. And I'm trying to get these two together. And that is complicated, just trying to get these two together in a print. And it kind of mimics that relationship in nature, you know, how they're kind of battling it out.
Kramer says she likes using art as a way to get people thinking about things they might not otherwise care about, or maybe never even knew existed. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Ever since residents in Flint, Michigan had to stop using their tap water because of dangerous lead levels, many Americans have asked themselves, do I have lead in my pipes and faucets? Closer to home, the state has ordered the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority to replace its lead service lines because water sampling indicated lead levels are above the federal action limit in some areas. Mark Brush, a reporter at Michigan Radio, wanted to know if he had lead pipes in his house, and he joins me now. So, Mark, to figure out if you had lead in your home plumbing, you started in the basement, right?
Yeah, it's just one of these questions that nagged at me for a long time, you know, in covering the Flint water crisis. We understood what happened there, and I wanted to find out what was going on in my home, because when we drink the water there, we drink it straight from the tap. So in order to figure that out, I called a local plumber and pipe fitters union here in Michigan, and they connected me with this guy named Randall Whitaker, and he trains plumbers for the local 190 here in Ann Arbor. And he came over to show me how to find out what kind of service line is coming into my house. And we found that down in the basement, low to the wall, there was a pipe coming out of the corner down there.
As you can see here, this is copper coming in. Where it looks the same, this is all copper, where it would be almost a rusty brown color.
Copper is good, that's not lead.
Yeah, he said if I had had a lead service line coming into the house there, when he scraped it with a screwdriver, the metal would have been soft and it would have turned real shiny. Aside from lead, you can also have plastic or galvanized steel coming into your house. If it's steel, a magnet would stick to it. If it's lead or copper, it just won't stick. And here's a little side note. It's possible that lead service line coming into your house is just partial. So there could be a section of that lead service line that is actually lead that you wouldn't know about. You might want to call your city and ask them if they know or if they can help you find out.
Okay, where else did the plumber say lead could be hiding out?
Well, I have an older house and the pipes are all copper in there. And he said that the solder that holds the joints together more than likely has lead in it.
You know, some of these joints, you can kind of do that scrape test as well. I don't know how well you can see it, but that joint has that matte dark gray finish. If you scrape it just a little bit, you see how it's got that bright silver color to it.
He said there's no way to know for sure just by looking at what that is. The solder, he thinks, is more than likely what they call 50-50 solder. So that's 50% lead and 50% tin. That was the kind of solder they used before 1986.
So your home plumbing could have lead in the service line and lead in the solder that connects the pipes. Where else could there be lead?
Well, a lot of faucets and valves in homes have brass in them. Brass is an alloy made mostly of copper and zinc. But when they made these faucets and valves before 2014, the brass also had some lead in it. Today, there's a new standard in place, and the faucets and valves that you get today have a lot less lead in them.
If you have a faucet in your house that was purchased and installed before 2014, should people replace it?
Well, you could if you're worried about it. The best way to find out what's going on in your house is just to test the water. That's the best way you can get a snapshot of what's going on inside your own home. Faucets are just easy to replace. They're not that cost prohibitive to replace, but replacing all your plumbing and your service line, that does get much more expensive. Several experts told us that you can just run your water for a few minutes before drinking or cooking. And then you can also buy a water filter that fits right onto your faucet. And when you do that, you want to look for filters that are certified to remove lead.
Well, thanks, Mark, and also thanks to your plumber.
You're welcome.
Mark Brush is with Michigan Radio. And you can find out more about lead in home plumbing at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Carol Holzapfel. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. Finally, we're taking a paddle down the Allegheny River. As part of our look at the unique people that shape life on Pittsburgh's three rivers, we caught up with some kids and adults who practice dragon boating. Never heard of it? Well, it started in ancient China and has become a popular sport on American rivers. But for the dragon boaters we met, it's about a lot more than competition.
My name's Jennifer Fiscus. I live in the north side of Pittsburgh. My daughter, Ella, started dragon boating last week. It was a hard sell. I came home with a piece of paper, like, let's dragon boat. And she was like, are you kidding me? No. And I'm afraid of the river.
My name is Ella. I'm 12 years old, and I'm here because
my mom signed me up for dragon boating. At first, I thought the boat was going to flip over. It was going to be terrible. But it turned out to be surprisingly fun.
Those of you who are new tonight, raise your hands. It's really good to have you. We'll get you fitted up with life jackets and paddles in just a few minutes. I'm Glenna Wilson, and I'm from Pittsburgh, and I work with Paddlers for Peace, which is a youth dragon boat league. The dragon boat is a really long canoe-like boat. It has 10 benches, 2 people sit per bench. It has a person on the front that beats a drum and a steer person on the back, and the paddlers paddle in rhythm with that drum.
Whole boat paddles up, go! Paddle together, guys. Let's take that wobble out of the boat.
The goal was to bring kids together from all different neighborhoods where, you know, with the turf wars and that kind of stuff that were going on, we hope to bring them together and have them have a peaceful experience. So our mission is to promote nonviolence, communicating better, listening, forgiving, respecting nature, and to introduce kids to water sports, mostly kids who don't have that opportunity. You know, they're not in one of the schools that has the rowing teams, those kinds of things.
Let it run! Hold the boat!
You know, every summer we may have one or two kids that may have some behavior issues that are difficult. And one summer we had a couple of girls, they were very disrespectful in the boat to the other kids. And our last night where we always celebrate, the coaches decided to take the kids to paddle them clear down to the point. And the boat didn't come back, and we were wondering where they were. And they had been near the point, and 2 speedboats went by on either side of the boat, and it flipped over, and everybody was fine. The kids were all fine. But they came back here, and we were kind of debriefing what had happened. And these 2 girls who had been so difficult spoke up and said, "We just thought it was so neat how we all worked together when that happened." And that was just like this complete turnaround in these 2 girls. And that was just, I almost cried when that happened. Lots of times you don't really realize the difference you're making when you're working with youth. They may never tell you, but you do make a difference.
Right side only. Drag your paddles. Good job. Nicely done, guys. Nicely done. As we come alongside, avoid the duck poop, but grab the duck.
Well, I kind of just like put myself out there with like, I didn't even think about it. I just did it. I've met a bunch of new people who surprisingly don't live in Northside, because I thought everybody like lived in Northside since I lived in Northside. So it was fun trying out a new thing. So listen to your mom, guys.
Always good advice. That story was produced by Lou Bluen. It's part of a series of portraits about life on the rivers. And you can find them all at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. Heat of the Moment is funded by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society. The Joyce Foundation at joycefdn.org.